This talk is a nice follow-up on the previous one. It focuses in particular on soil organic carbon patterns across a large mixed-use landscape in southeastern U.S., in particular Florida. I'd like to acknowledge my co-authors and also many, many people who helped to make this study happen. Major funding came from USDA, formerly NI, now AFRI, NIFA. This is a core project of the North American Carbon Program. Now, when we talk about carbon, we have to look at the major carbon pools. And globally, earlier assessment indicated that soils account for about 1,600 petagrams of carbon, added peat 360. But we see also that major fluxes occur between the biosphere and atmosphere, and previously assessed 50 petagram decomposition, 50 soil respiration, and also a substantial amount of fire. Now, all these assessments of global carbon pools, and here only three select sources listed are first one by Lal, Ratan Lal, second one by the U.S. Climate Change Science Program and IPCC, the last one. You see also that these assessments of soil organic carbon pools differ quite a bit because we are here in the we are using petagrams. So these are substantial actually differences. So there's a lot of uncertainty still left to assess carbon stocks across large landscapes and in particular across global scales. Now, there's agreement that the carbon pool is much, much larger compared to the atmospheric and vegetation pool. But also the sequence of these declines in terms of different carbon pools differs among different publications. And there's ongoing debate related to the impact of climate warming on soil carbon. Research has shown that if temperature increases, we are dealing with increased rates of decomposition, raising CO2 emissions into the atmosphere, creating a positive climate feedback. But other findings have shown that if these increases of plant-derived carbon exceed the decomposition rate, we create a negative climate feedback. Now, in addition to this ongoing debate, there are, of course, many, many confounding factors, including land use management, land management, land use change, fire, hydrologic conditions, and of course, different soils respond very differently to changes, in particular also temperature changes and precipitation changes associated also with climate warming. Now, a recent study indicated that soil respiration rates have been increasing at a rising rate. So we are dealing with major amounts of CO2 emitted into the atmosphere through soil respiration. And recent assessments, this is in 2010, a publication by Bond, Lamberti, and Thompson in Nature, indicated that 98 petagram of carbon were emitted globally by soil respiration. So these are large numbers, double as high as previous assessments. So on a per year basis, this amounts to 0.1 petagram. Now, if we could assess all these different fluxes across an ecosystem, we could derive an ecosystem carbon balance. The difficulties that we change to assess changes related to the atmosphere, but also below ground and exchanges between soil, vegetation, and also emissions into the atmosphere is that these are very, very difficult to measure, assess spatially and temporally. There's a lot of heterogeneity in space and time. And in particular, those systems that are undergoing change, successional and managed ecosystems, it takes several years to decades to detect this change significantly. That's why indirect measurements have been suggested to assess the change in total carbon in ecosystems over measured time intervals. Of course, one difficulty taking this approach is to derive historic data and compare them to current ones. This was attempted in this study, where our objectives were to assess historic soil organic carbon stocks within a large subtropical landscape, which is characterized by high net ecosystem productivity. It's a centrish soil landscape interspersed with a lot of hydric soils and wetlands. The second objective was to quantify soil organic carbon sequestration rates across ecological gradients, and finally to elucidate on spatially explicit relationships between So I look at carbon sequestration, environmental state factors, and environmental forcings. In particular, we don't focus on land use and climate change. So in essence, we wanted to explain what is causing also soil organic carbon change in a landscape. What this study is and what it's not. It's not a controlled plot study where we use paired site experiments, which is usually done at fine scale. It's also not a meta-analysis where disparate data sets are tried to be synthesized and findings are derived. This study truly uses measurements, historic and current ones, along huge gradients covering hydrologic, soil, land use, and climatic trajectories. It's an fusion of the measurements of soil organic carbon and, in addition, spatially explicit environmental variables and forcings. And I will talk about this topic also later on. Now, this landscape in Florida is very diverse. We are dealing with sandwich soils, loamy sediments interspersed with separate organic material, secondary carbonates overlying limestone bedrock, and major soil orders are spodosols, antisols, ultisols, but also a major proportion are in histosols, high organic soils. Mean annual precipitation about 1,300 millimeter, and it's in a relatively flat landscape, muted topography, with a major amount of flatwoods. These are the predominant landforms in this subtropical landscape, covering about 50% of Florida. Now, if you look at the productivity of this system, it's a highly productive system, creating a lot of biomass, and I'm talking here about the above-ground biomass. Net primary productivity and gross primary productivity, particularly very high values in aquatic systems here interspersed, also particularly St. John's Basin of Florida and also the Okeechobee Basin here in central Florida. Now, coming to the data set that we assembled to conduct this study, in 2008 and majorly in 2009, we sampled over 1,000 sites throughout the whole state. This was based on a stratified random sampling using land uses and soil suborders as strata. We revisited over 453 historic sites. And this dates back from an historic data set called the Florida Soil Characterization Database that covers a time period from 1965 to 1996. And in addition, we sampled 561 reconnaissance sites. So in total, we had a set of 1,014 sites. You see here distributed across the whole state. The historic sites that matched and were collocated with current sites highlighted in red within 30 meters, and historic and current ones within a 300 meter distance are highlighted in green. We have good coverage over the whole state, except here for the southern tip of Florida that we could not sample in this study. The historic data set covers a land area of over 150,000 square kilometers, a very large area. This was done based on horizon-based sampling down to a depth of 2 meters, including bulk density measurements, and soil organic carbon was derived using Walkley Black modified acid dichromate method on mineral soils and loss on ignition on organic soils. These were the standard methods at the time. Now, if we assess the soil organic carbon stocks across the whole state, here you see the distribution patterns in terms of the observations. This was done down to 1 meter. We see here two different techniques, block rigging and class pedal transfer function based on land use and soil order. There are major amounts of carbon stored across the landscape, in particular in South and Central Florida, up to 50 kilograms per square meter, whereas the minor amounts are found in the northern portion of the state. Block kriging, a similar technique like in the previous presentation, and kriging technique that is a univariate technique that maps out the carbon across the landscape. Now, in addition, we use several upscaling techniques and average the results to derive and mean soil organic carbon stock value across the whole state. Also considering available data sets from NRCS, SURGO, and STATSCO values, because we wanted to really pool these data, create an average, because probably the true value is somewhere in the middle. This accounted for 4.11 petagram of carbon, or 0.2% of soil carbon on Earth, and major amount. We see the mean soil organic carbon stocks ranged up to 47.8 kilogram per square meter, and we are quite in the ballpark with previous publications, for example, by Google, who used JASCO, very coarse data sets, who amounted, who derived 35.2 kilogram per square meter of carbon. But this was done here down to 2 meter. Now, shifting to the current soil organic carbon data set collected major in 2009, where we are used on composite sampling at each site down to 20 centimeter depth. Total carbon was measured by combustion techniques and inorganic carbon by phosphoric acid extraction and soil organic carbon derived by subtraction between total carbon and inorganic carbon. Bulk density was measured to derive carbon stocks. And we see here, again, two different representations to assess soil organic carbon. And one issue, of course, is that depending on the upscaling techniques, you derive different values. They are quite substantially different, so they are associated with quite a bit of uncertainty, of course. We see, again, general patterns that carbon values tend to be lower in the panhandle area in the northern part of Florida. But again, here the assessment is done only to a depth of 20 centimeter. So values tend to be lower. Only the maximum value measured was, or estimated here was 25 SOC kilogram per square meter. But what you can see is that this landscape is very heterogeneous in terms of the carbon content that differs across the landscape. Now, to harmonize these different data sets, historic and current, we standardized them to 20 centimeter and also accounted for the differences in measurement techniques. So we developed Florida-specific pedo transfer function to convert the Walkley-Black historic measurements to combustion carbon values and the LOI historic values to combustion. And this was done by pedo transfer functions to put them into the same data space. Now, when we look at the data sets, historic and current, and compare these values to each other, in terms of the mean value, actually, there's not much different among the observation sites. Also, the maximum values, these are standardized to 20 centimeter, are quite comparable. But the distribution patterns are somewhat different because the median differs, so does the standard deviation in these data sets. Now, this landscape, of course, is diverse. We are dealing with different types of land uses that might be also associated with soil organic carbon stocks. Every thing you can find in Florida, from very xeric sandhill system dry prairies to hammocks, or in particular also extensively pine flatwood systems, upland or hardwood system. But the major amount is also in various types of agricultural production. And of course, prominent in Florida, also wetlands and forest swamps, and also urban systems that are quite diverse in terms of their use and intensity of urbanization. Now, if we map out the soil organic carbon stocks by land use classes, we see several distinct patterns. In particular, the sugarcane production sites show very high carbon values. And this is peculiar in Florida because they are only majorly grown on organic soils in the Everglades agricultural area, very geographically clustered. Now, not surprisingly, wetland sites are ranked very high in terms of their carbon values, followed by improved pastures, urban system, pine forest, mesic upland forest. And at the lower portion, we had rangeland systems, agricultural systems, citrus, and xeric upland forest. So this mirrors our previous studies also published, but I will explain later also that land use is only one component that might impact soil organic carbon, but there are many other factors, of course, that can confound also the relationships. Now, if you look at the distribution of current versus the historic soil organic carbon stocks, collocated sites so less than 30 meters, we see here that there's change happening in this landscape. There are gains and losses that we are dealing with. And this mirrors also here at sites separated by less than 300 meters. Again, we have to deal with gains and losses. Now, if we look at how much on the collocated sites were gained and lost, It is quite evident from this graph that we have more gains that were measured and fewer losses. The soil organic carbon sequestration mean value in this landscape amounted to 11.6 gram carbon per square meter and year. Now, we looked here in this study at a time period covering, in average, 30.3 years, where historic and current sites were separated by several decades. And this is also quite important to know because total carbon or soil organic carbon can only be significantly measured over longer periods of time. There has been study by Smith, also in the UK, done using power analysis that indicated that at least 10 years are necessary to significantly identify carbon change in a system. Now, if you look at the distribution patterns of soil organic carbon sequestration, here plotted out are the sites that have gained carbon, with the filled circles and the hollow circles indicate carbon losses. We have a distribution of sites across the whole state. Some of these sites were clustered relatively close together, while others were very far apart. Now, if you look at soil organic carbon sequestration rates by field observed land use, we find also distinct patterns. The highest amounts were found here in wetland systems and also improved pasture. So in essence, we find also very similar trends, as I previously showed, related to land uses associated with soil organic carbon stocks. We have losses in agricultural system and citrus system in particular, and also in xeric upland forest, very dry systems which cannot hold much carbon in the soil. But it's not only the land use that matters here. It is also the persistence of land use or land use change. So we looked at a time period from 1970 to 2009 where land use data were available from various sources across the whole state and identified each site depending on their land use persistence. So sites that were persistently in one specific land use class, for example, state as in wetland, were ranked as number 6, and those that changed land use quite often were ranked with lower numbers, here 1 and 2. And we see also that in particular, gains were found here in persistent wetland classes. I cannot show you this graph based on time constraints. But we see also clear trends that in particular, if you have systems that are changing forth and back in terms of their land use, of course, the gains and losses might be actually smaller than one site consistently staying in, for example, improved pasture or consistently staying in wetland. So this is quite important to include and consider also in our thinking of modeling and estimating also soil organic carbon sequestration. This is the next step in our analysis where we try to develop a spatial-temporal model to estimate soil organic carbon sequestration. It's based on a spatially explicit model that uses a function that is based on environmental state factors that are spatially and temporally explicit. And in addition, also functions that integrate dynamic environmental forcings that are also spatially and temporally explicit, but condensed or aggregated over specific time periods, so that we identify also the trend in land use change, the trend in climate change in our model, and can capture this effect also in our spatial-temporal model to estimate soil organic carbon sequestration. Now, what are these properties that were included and considered in our model? The state factors are simple environmental factors that can be measured across a landscape, like in digital elevation model and topographic derivatives. We have soil properties derived from soil information system, in particular using also NRCS databases, geology maps, that give us clues about our parent material. Now, in terms of the spatial-temporal environmental forcings, they are, of course, more difficult to derive. You looked here at patterns from 1971 to early 2000 in terms of precipitation rates. And I will show you here in short sequence and how precipitation on a monthly basis changed over the time period aggregated. We see here also in the summer months, we have very high precipitation rates which differ across the whole state. If we move on to the drier period, for example, November, December. But if we amount and aggregate this change in precipitation and also in temperature across the whole state, we find huge gradients that differ from the northern part of Florida to the southern part, with a change of over 700 millimeters, which is tremendous across the whole state. Actually, the driest areas in terms of the precipitation or lowest precipitation rates can be found here in the center of the state. Also, in terms of the average maximum temperature, looking at a time period from 1971 to 2000, so decades of change, we find here differences between 24 here up in the Panhandle to the southern tip of Florida, 30 degree Celsius. So there are tremendous climatic gradients found across the area. This has been also found by in other studies here looking at time periods dating back to 1901 from NOAA, that in particular here in the southern area of Florida, indicating that the change in precipitation and temperature is largest, whereas in the northern portion, actually the change is not as dramatic as in the center and southern portion of the state. Now, if you project things into the future, of course, we see also tremendous differences in terms of climate that are projected. Here, using a high emission scenario from the Climate Change Impact Program US, we might be dealing with increases in temperature of 8 to 10 degrees Fahrenheit. And an optimistic scenario, a lower emission scenario, maybe in the range of 4 to 6 degree Fahrenheit, indicated over here. So we are facing also in the future probably major changes in terms of climatic patterns across the whole state. Now, if you look at land use change patterns across the area from 1970 to 2003, we see here only the major land use classes aggregated and mapped out. But there's a tremendous, really, change across this time period. And I didn't forget to plot here the map. This was simply not mapped. Unfortunately, it was not available. But we see across this time period an urbanization trend and decline in agricultural production, and forth and back shifting in terms of rangeland coverage, and slight decline in forest and major decline in wetlands. So there's a lot of land use shifts documented across the whole area. Now I could show you 206 of these environmental maps that we aggregated, considering all the different environmental properties that possibly could relate to soil organic carbon change, including different soil properties, geologic properties, topographic, climatic properties, and in particular also biotic properties, derived from various remote sensing products, including Landsat, MODIS, to map out land use history, productivity, NDVI, that indicates also the change in chlorophyll content or the green biomass, phenology, and more. Now, of course, these are huge data sets where we needed a processing technique that can account and compute also and deal with various data sources, including categorical and continuous data. And we decided on a data mining method approach where regression trees and ensemble trees are combined. In essence, the environmental input variables that I just presented to you in forms of spatial and temporal explicit grids were entered as predictor variables to estimate and infer on soil organic carbon sequestration. Now, because we had such a comprehensive data set, the first step was to reduce the data space. So we identified really the key predictor variables. He identified 26 in total based on regression trees conducted within the different subgroups of soils, geology, topography, and so on and so forth. Because otherwise, we would have too much interaction and too much redundancy in our data set, which we wanted to avoid. Now, to give you an example how this subgrouping processing worked and to identify the major predictors, here are an example from the biotic MODIS group. And MODIS is a remote sensor that can infer on various vegetation-specific properties like NDVI green-up rate ranked very high as a predictor, including also enhanced vegetation index calculated at specific days of a year. And this is a modification of NDVI that expresses also the change in chlorophyll content, accounting also for soil, modified by soil properties, and also correction based on the blue band that considers atmospheric scattering. But in essence, 26 of these key environmental properties were identified to be processed in an regression tree model that we used in VVOLT cross-validation mode. In essence, what you see here, and you might not see from the back the numbers, that's why I color-coded it to make it also visible for you to grasp intuitively also the results. The most parsimonious trees are shown in these columns, and the more complex tree-based model to infer on soil organic carbon sequestration rate in the last column, which also had the lowest error to assess SOC sequestration. Now, the white grayish color indicates the geologic properties. A green color represents biotic factors, vegetation land use change. Blue here, the climatic factors, and brown are soil, and pink are the topographic properties. So we see in particular in terms of the variable importance that besides official geology, only land use or biotic properties and climatic properties ranked very high to infer on soil organic carbon sequestration. And this suggests that these two different groups of environmental forcings also determine really the change of soil organic carbon in the system. Of course, there were other properties, including soil properties, topographic properties, that had some predictive power, but less so than climatic and biotic factors. Now, these preliminary models are very, very promising in terms of explaining also soil organic carbon sequestration in this landscape. This contrasts the predicted soil organic carbon sequestration and observed one based on an ensemble tree. These are aggregated trees in bagging mode that also identifies and in essence creates hundreds of trees to make predictions. Still, there's a lot of unexplained variability, and this will be the next step to explain also the remaining portions and track them down to identify truly and link soil organic carbon sequestration to environmental properties. Now some final remarks. In this study, we looked at a high productive system that also stores major amounts of carbon. We contrasted historic and current carbon stocks. In this landscape, we are dealing with tremendous variability in terms of the environmental state factors, but also of other environmental forcings, including land use and climate change, that have changed the system tremendously over the past decades. We looked at environmental forcings which impacted soil organic carbon sequestration and found that there are truly complex interactions between the environmental forcings and the environmental state variables. And this has been also overlooked in a lot of meta-analysis and other studies that truly looked at only portions of the system, but not the whole complexity of an ecosystem. Now, there's more ongoing research out of our research group that is also presented at this meeting, and I invite you also to stop by at some of our presentations that are at Wednesday by Brent Myers, Wade Ross, Xiong Xiong, to learn more about ongoing predictive carbon modeling in the state of Florida. And with that, I thank you very much.
Very good. Do we have a question or two for Sabine?
At one point in your talk, you related the pedal transfer function to relate loss on ignition to something, like 50%. Was that organic carbon, or is that organic matter, or what were you relating that
pedal transfer function? Right. We developed pedal transfer function to convert loss on ignition data to combustion data to make them
right. Organic matter.
Well, soil organic matter converted, but in essence, it was soil organic
carbon.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. So then 50% the organic carbon on Washington, the LOI was essentially double the amount of organic carbon calculated by Los Angeles.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. But important with also pedo transfer functions is, of course, if you use a generic one, then of course you might deal with the larger uncertainties. Here we actually developed our own pedo transfer function that are specific to Florida soils, because we also strive to reduce the uncertainty in our model as much as possible, because there are many, many factors that can impact your analysis and confound your relationships.
All right. Thanks very much, Sabine.